Welcome to the Life as a Coder podcast series, brought to you by Ozark Institute, an initiative of OncoSpark, a technology-enabled revenue cycle management company, discussing your life as a medical coder, offering tips and advice for coding students and professionals. Join us every Wednesday.
Hello and welcome to the Life as a Coder podcast. My name is Jennifer McNamara, and I am your host today. As always, our goal here at the Life as a Coder podcast is to bring you those industry topics in health information management and tips for work-life balance. I want to thank our sponsors over at OncoSpark, a technology-enabled revenue cycle management company. We hope you've been enjoying these last few seasons, and season six has been, so far, packed with some great interviews and great content. We really love bringing you industry topics, news, things that will help you in your everyday career as a coder, a biller, an auditor, any role in the business of healthcare. But we also, of course, care about you providers out there. We care about you physicians, you clinicians, those of you in the clinical space, because we don't exist without you. And of course, we know that our support is vital to your success. So we have prepared a nice episode really designed to help coders, billers, administrators, and physicians, clinicians to be successful and to learn how to communicate and collaborate. I have my very special guest, Leslie Bowles. I'm so excited to share the conversation that we had on communication, some of the gaps, but also the opportunities that we have to improve in our communication skills. Leslie has over 20 years of experience in regulatory compliance solutions, revenue cycle support, and she has helped many hospitals, facilities, physicians, and coders be successful in their career. So stay tuned for my interview of Leslie Bowles.
Healthcare operating costs are on the rise, and denied claims are wasting your time and costing your practice money. Most denials are due to coding inaccuracies because billing and coding staff may lack the proper education or are just spread way too thin. But all of this is preventable with focused and uninterrupted verification. Introducing Code Interceptor, a solution designed to intercept your claims before they're submitted. Ensure accuracy, reduce denials and appeals, and increase timely payments. Our team of service line coding experts, supported by advanced technology, work intimately with your practice to reduce billing and coding burdens so you can focus on what matters most, patient care. Every day, you'll receive a detailed report that identifies errors and inquiries so your staff can quickly make the necessary corrections. And you'll have access to a unique dashboard of analytics that highlights problematic trends, allowing you to resolve common issues proactively. With staffing shortages, Code Interceptor can create confidence and consistency. Are you ready to reclaim your time and revenue? Contact us today for a no-obligation consultation.
As mentioned, I have my very special guest, Leslie Bowles, and we are so excited to talk about physician education and just being a physician advocate. Welcome to the show, Leslie.
Thank you. Thanks for having me. Super excited to be here.
Well, I'm just really grateful that you reached out, and we have so much to talk about today. It's hard to believe we're going to cram all of this information into one episode, but we will do our best to answer all of these questions that have been on the minds of individuals for so long. Now, we know, especially since the pandemic started, physicians have been feeling the burden and the burden documentation, not only that, but from a clinical side, right? Just being able to every day take care of their patients. And you add on the burden of getting paid and worrying about getting paid for the services you need to provide to patients. It can really add to that burden. And so we want to find a way to help them, right? Feel less pressure, less burdened. And but before we do that, I want to get to our audience to get to know you a little bit better. So I want to ask you, first of all, how did you get started in healthcare?
Okay, so I have a very interesting story about that. I started in healthcare when I was 16, working at an ophthalmologist office. And what, in doing so, what it allowed me to realize is that I wanted to be in healthcare because I've always had this purposeful desire to help people, right? But I also realized that I did not want to be on the clinical side. So from the age of 16 all the way working from physician practices to working at a hospital at the age of 20, I sort of navigated into the administrative side of things, which allowed me to be introduced to careers like coding and compliance and other, you know, related fields. So that was my beginning, just trying to make a few extra bucks, probably to go to Great Adventure or something at the time, just soliciting my services to local physician practices to be a receptionist. And it turned into a whole purposeful career for me. So that's how I started at the age of 16, taking out the trash at an ophthalmologist's office and checking patients in.
Well, Leslie, I am going to have to let you know that is exactly how I started, like word for word. This is too funny because my very first job, I was a little older than that, but my very first official medical office job was in ophthalmology. I had just gotten married and I was looking for a job like that. And so, yeah, it was crazy. Like same exact, same specialty, you know, that's how I kind of found my passion. And I love ophthalmology to this day, and I still love to teach about it. So that is wonderful. And I feel like there's a lot of us out there that have that very similar beginning, at least back, you know, when we started those years ago, because that was kind of how you did start in coding. There has been a progression, right? Yes. With remote coding now and people going into because they want to work remotely. But I don't know. I feel like the challenges I faced and just the experiences I had prepared me for the role I have now. And I would never change any of it. I wouldn't change a thing. How about you? How do you feel about it?
Yeah, no, I wouldn't. You know, the beginning of my career, I think, taught me really how to understand how to navigate the healthcare industry from a non-clinical perspective, right? And I think there was a lot of lessons that I learned being a receptionist and a secretary and an administrative assistant that are very valuable to the effective communication aspect of communicating with physicians and other providers. Whereas if I think back on it, if I had just jumped into a coding role without that previous or prior experience on how to learn how to effectively communicate, maybe over something as simple as ordering paper, I probably wouldn't be as effective as I am today. So I say all that to say, because I mentor a lot of people and most people want to start off at the top of the stairs, right? But there's something really valuable about starting at the bottom step and working your way up, because unfortunately, if you skip steps, you miss the opportunity to learn. And that's what a lot of newer coders forget, right? Of course, there's plenty of opportunity. There's plenty of, you know, experience that you will get along the way, but there's some very valuable experiences you get to taking the slow and steady rate. So I think that's my previous experience has definitely taught me that for sure.
I agree. And, you know, I always ask my guests because I'm passionate about healthcare and of course coding, but just being able to see my role in healthcare. What makes you passionate about what you do and how your passion grew over the years?
Yeah, so this is a very interesting question. What I am most passionate about is improving someone else's quality of life, right? I think we take for granted that there are a lot of people, when you talk about quality of life, we always associate it with financial, right? It's more money. But I have seen for people who truly love coding, they find purpose in it. They find passion in it because they're contributing to the entire clinical picture, although sometimes it's not described that way. Ensuring that an organization is appropriately reimbursed for the services they provided also ensures the financial sustainability of that organization, which is a very critical aspect to any healthcare organization. So I personally, when I think about coding and mentoring other people, I think about how can I help them become the best version of their self? How can I help them improve their overall quality of life? How can I help them to be a happier person about it? And that's just mainly because that's who I am, right? I want to make sure I'm living life to its absolute fullest and being my happiest. So yeah, that's it in a nutshell.
That's beautiful. I feel I have the same sentiment. And from both of us, I think we've kind of worked in this administrative role in many times in our career, and we've seen things, maybe the average coder that's just coding every day, and they don't see all of the higher up decisions that are made,
right,
and how it trickles down to them. And I am always huge about that, understanding each other's role, whether you are, you know, coding or a receptionist, you know, you have a manager that is in charge of that. I had so much respect for my manager once I learned all the things that she did every day, all of the grief that she was handed down to her from higher ups above her. And then I experienced that myself at one point in my career. And I couldn't believe what the stress level is for someone in administration. Like it's a lot of stress because, you know, the patients are a priority. Like they really are the reason we're in healthcare. We can't keep the doors open, then they're suffering. And right. I'm suffering as a patient, right? We're all patients.
Right. Exactly right. And,
do you have a favorite doctor you like to go see?
Possibly going to the eye doctor. That's one that I don't have to necessarily kind of pull myself to. Working in healthcare, sometimes you kind of think you know what's going on with yourself because you see so many different, you know, clinical treatments and diagnoses. So I try not to, you know, like they say, WebMD myself, right? And force right. myself to go to the doctor's office. And the other thing is, because of what I do from a compliance standpoint, when I go to the doctor's office, sometimes they look at me like, well, why are you here? I'm like, I'm just here to get a checkup. That's all. I'm not here for anything else. But like, what are you doing here? Are you coming to investigate our records? No, that's not what I'm coming to do. So it's interesting, but I do, you know, I do like going to the eye doctor. I think maybe it's because of how I started, right? I find the test fascinating, you know, the visual field, all that good stuff. So yeah, that's one position, one office I do like to go to.
That's really cool. Yeah. Well, for me, like it's, yeah. I mean, nobody wants to go to the doctor. I mean, like if you don't want to have a reason to go, right?
Right.
But I feel like if I had to go, I know specific offices that I've been to that I just feel comfortable there. Right. And right, so right. I think about that, like there is a huge thing happening in the industry right now. People don't know about how many hospitals, how many practices are facing closure because yeah. of the financial pull that they're feeling. And people, the average, you know, even average person that is just in the medical office doesn't really know what's really going on behind the scenes and what their facility is facing. So I think if we can figure this out, or at least do something to not add to the problem, but be the solution.
Yeah.
Then we can really feel like we're affecting change in some way. That's what we're here for today, right? We're here yeah. to talk about what we do and why our job is so important and how we can be an advocate for physicians. Now, they're facing these burdens, right? In your opinion, maybe some of the thoughts you've come across on how we can be their advocate. What do we need to do, at least on a basic level?
Well, you know, I have prided myself in any organization that I've been, I think it's important to differentiate between the clinical aspects of healthcare and the financial aspect, right? There are subject matter experts on both sides. And I think what has happened over the course of the last, and I'll just use the last 10 to 15 years, is that in healthcare, we've muddied the waters, right? We've created technology that has said, the physician now can be the coder, which will increase your efficiency and your productivity. And in my opinion, that's a mistake, right? Because physicians go to medical school so that they can learn how to treat humans and treat patients at its highest level, right? And keep patients healthy. That is a huge undertaking. So to dilute it with another really special skill set that you need, like coding and reimbursement and healthcare finance, I think is where the first mistake happened. And I'm all for the advancements in technology. I'm very much so for them. But what it did is said that one person can do it all. And that is not the case, right? The other downfall is that, and that I've seen in a lot of organizations, is that the biller, the coder, right? Those individuals are some of the most important roles in that organization. However, they receive the least amount of pay, right? And they receive the least amount of education. from an organizational standpoint. Coders and billers should be attending conferences every year. They should be in educational seminars in the same way that you think about a resident when they go and they're learning, right? They're required to go to their meetings each week, their educational meetings, their sessions. And even when they become physicians and fully credentialed, they have to continue on with their education and all that good stuff. And I think that is an area that globally needs to be looked at, because if you were to tie the current financial crisis in healthcare with the way in which financial organizations are structured, right? The way they operationalize their financial or their revenue cycle departments or their CBOs, or how they integrate the clinicians into the coding process, it would help you to, if you unwind that, you would see where the original problem started. So, you know, lots of times when I say that, most organizations are like, well, it's too late. We're already here, right? But globally, no. I think if we made a conscious decision to say, all right, the regulations, the billing and coding regulations are not going to let up. They're going to be here, right? The rules are going to be here. We need to get subject matter experts in the right seats. We need to provide our clinicians with the support that they need, right? So that their work integrates with how we are reimbursed, but we need to do that quickly. So that's, I feel like the origin of where all of these financial issues have come into play is based on how we have shortcutted our healthcare system. The way we said we can make one person the master of all things. And that's just not possible. There's not one of us that know everything. So
I love what you said about technology, because, you know, I love technology and there are so many wonderful solutions out there. You know, at OncoSpark, we create solutions, but it's not designed for one person to do it all. It's designed for a team to be efficient. That's what technology is supposed to do. It's right. Supposed to make your jobs more efficient. So you're spending less time on these tasks that can be automated, where you still have to have a brain behind it, right? Technology right. doesn't work unless someone behind the scenes is making it work. Physicians should not be the one that does the coding and see the patients. That's too much for one person completely.
Right. Absolutely.
I have seen that for sure. I have seen that be a problem. There was one EMR, which I won't mention by name, but it's very popular and many organizations use it. And one of the drawbacks of it was the fact that the physician could, you know, start typing in a diagnosis. It will pull up a list. They would just be in a hurry, right? They don't have time to pick it. They pick a code, right? It ends up on the official document. And that's what the coders use and the billers use, is that code. And they don't look at the official plan, the assessment plan, to see what was actually documented. And see that the code they just picked, they put in the system that went to the insurance company, is unspecified, right? Oh my goodness, my biggest pet peeve. There has to be a way around that, or better training, right? So yes, this EMR has great features and it's very nice and it's easy, user-friendly for a lot of people. And I think part of the problem too was the burdens the physicians had with their documentation. They liked these systems because they made maybe their documentation a little quicker, a little easier, but maybe not as accurate when it comes to reimbursement, right? So what is your take on, I'm just going to ask you this question, on the current system we have when it comes to like EMRs and EHRs, what are some of the things you have seen in the ones you've used that contribute to this issue?
Well, you know, I think the biggest issue that I've seen is the cloning, copy and pasting, right? I understand completely the intent of what the pull forward mechanism is in most EMRs or EHRs, or the cloning mechanism is. However, I think what ends up happening with technology that a lot of us don't realize, as humans, we're using technology as a crutch, right? So we're saying, you know, what I've seen from a clinician standpoint, it's like, okay, the system will do it for me, right? But when you think back to where the systems did not exist, when we're just on paper, the doctor had to physically write out, I'm doing a review of systems. I'm performing a physical examination. I'm performing a medical decision-making. And I think the way that physicians or clinicians need to look at EMRs and EHRs, it's a tool. It is not the decision maker, right? And that's the confusion about technology. Yes, there's a lot of very cool features that enhance the decision-making process for the physician or the clinician. However, as the physician or clinician, you are still in the driver's seat, right? You tell the technology what to do. The technology doesn't tell you what to do, especially because we are treating patients. They are treating patients, right? Each patient has its own makeup, its own specific, each patient is unique. Let's put it that way. And so therefore, technology, and if you read a lot about some of the biases that they are running into right now with artificial intelligence and machine learning, technology is not designed as of yet, although they are making some headway, to be able to give that human personal touch where it allows you to see the uniqueness of each patient and then document or memorialize the outcome in the way that it should. It's not there yet, right? So I think that there needs to be one, I've always say there's nothing wrong with features of EMRs and EHRs, but there needs to be better oversight of what is happening behind the scenes. So one of the things that I always sort of preach about, and I'll just get on my soapbox here for a second, is as an organization, do you know all of the automated features that your system can do? Are you aware? And what that means is, do you know what the system does on your behalf for you without you even touching it? That is a big area of concern. It's not just with rev cycle or billing or coding. It's also on the clinical side. There are some automated machine learning, artificial intelligence that happens that assists the physician in the decision-making process for patients, right? There's nothing wrong with that as long as you know what the system is doing. And what I'm finding is a lot of times they don't know because this is so new. It's newly integrated into the system. So that's another area. I mean, we can probably talk for hours about the fact that codes, what I find with some of the systems is that the EHR and EMR companies will create technology that I won't use the word shortcut, right? Because that's a little harsh, but it will create easier processes for its clients, right? That can sometimes lead to things like incorrect coding or incorrect code descriptions. One of the biggest things that I have seen that's really just a pet peeve of mine is code description. So code description should be reflective of the code as it is in the American Medical Association CPT book or in the ICD-10 from the World Health Organization. It should be reflective of that for accuracy, right? So you're ensuring that the clinician who's selecting it or the coder biller who's selecting it is accurately picking the right one, not based on the fact that your system only allows 30 characters and your description is maybe 67, right? So there's little nuances like that that I think a lot of organizations miss the opportunity to talk about before they even install, right? So at one of my former employers, one of the things that we did when we rolled in a new system is we actually sat down and said, all right, show us from A to Z, what does the system do? Just tell us. And at the time, we weren't even thinking about it from an artificial intelligence or machine learning or whatever the case may be. We just wanted to know everything the system does. And this wasn't myself in the compliance department. This was the finance department. This was the clinical IT. We sort of collaborated and said it's for the benefit of the organization for us to know everything so that we know if Dr. X pressed this button, it's going to produce this outcome over here. A lot of folks don't know that. So I do think, one of just to go back to our original point about why do we think the healthcare industry is in this financial turmoil, the other thing is, as an industry, we are very reactive. We are very reactive. We think if we spend too much time on the beginning of the project, we're wasting time, we're wasting money. But if we were to do actual studies on organizations that proactively tackled some of these huge issues, or I shouldn't say huge, small little nuances that prevented huge issues, oh my goodness, it probably would be astronomical. And I think that's what needs to happen for the entire industry. So I know I'm on a tangent here, but I'm just giving you some of what I see from EHRs and EMRs, they are really good for the healthcare industry if they are used appropriately.
Absolutely, 100%. And, you know, I'm a huge advocate for that, be involved in the process too. I know when we had a client that we were helping with their consulting in plastic surgery, you know, they whenever we bring on a new client, for some reason, they always ask me if they want to, if they're opening a practice, I help them set up their practice. They ask me what software they should use. And so that's part of my process, is I actually help them do the research because of my knowledge and experience in what happens behind the scenes. Not, and I understand the clinical side too. I mean, right, that was my job for so many years, is to help the clinicians with their documentation. So I had to know what the software does for them, and exactly the things you're telling me, like, and telling our audience, it's important that you're involved in the process. Everyone that touches that EMR, whether it's, you know, the billers, the coders, the practice managers, the clinicians, everyone should understand what it does and how it affects their job. We had a software for this plastic surgeon that they employed, and it's wonderful, but there were some challenges along the way, little nuances that, you know, we anticipated and worked through. But they did have an effect on the clinical side. Some of the things that were pulled in from the code book didn't exactly match, you know, what should have been said in that note. And it did create some confusion, you know, especially in this day and age when patients get a hold of the record. We have to tactfully explain to them that this is the medical term that is used. In a world where there is sensitivity, there is a need to be cautious in documentation, especially when we're thinking about how sensitive these topics are to certain individuals. And that is something we face in plastic surgery. We face these issues with documentation and helping our patients feel comfortable coming to us. And they look at documentation. If they see their records, they can get offended, and they can get this feeling of not feeling comfortable with you as a physician if that is the case. And so that's just something I like to bring up that does affect documentation, whether you believe it or not. There may be some listeners out there that think that this doesn't mean anything, right?
Right.
But to certain patients, it does mean something to them. And so that's something that I sometimes think about, is we're here to take care of the patients and make them feel comfortable and make them feel cared for. Right. So those are things that documentation can do. Now, let's circle back to this topic of, we talked about the burden, right? And one of the things that what the 2021 evaluation management guidelines were designed to do, the American Medical Association put this out, what one of their goals, right, was to relieve some of the burden that the physicians were facing. You know, even for me as a coder, I mean, I felt burdened, right? So I'm trying to, you know, look at the exam, the history, making sure that, you know, obviously things weren't cloned, that we could actually verify that this was current information. What can we pull out of the history? What can we, all of these items that had to come together. And the average coder who did evaluation management was struggling because they weren't clinically trained. And some of the items you had to pull out, you did have to have some clinical knowledge of things. And so it was difficult for me specifically when I was learning this, but I was excited. My whole career, I loved MDM. I'm one of those weirdos that just, it was my favorite part of the note. I didn't really like exam or history. Like, it's important, but I felt the physician should get paid for the decision they're making. That is where the money should come from. So I was very excited. What have you seen? And when these, of course, were come on the scene, what was the reaction that you had seen from physicians specifically?
Well, one of the most interesting reactions that I received was, oh, Leslie, so you're telling me I don't have to document a history and physical exam anymore. Hallelujah. And that is not what the 2021 E&M regulations were saying. They were simply saying, we're no longer going to tell you what specific type of history or physical exam you need to have in order to assign those new and established outpatient E&M codes. You know, I'm a huge advocate of education. So for example, in one organization that I worked with, we actually took the bull by the horn when the new 2021 E&M coding changes came out. I was super excited because this was a chance for me to educate. This is my thing, right? Educating. And what I did was we created a PowerPoint, right? I think it was no more than about 11 slides that got down to the nitty gritty of what the key significant changes are, what it means for you, and how you implement them. And to your point about coders, for some coders, it being difficult because they do not have the clinical background, One of the things that I have seen in a lot of organizations that coders do not do is collaborate with physicians and clinicians, right? They are the clinical people, right? So they are the ones that probably should be giving you the scenarios that you're going to educate their colleagues on regarding the changes, right? And when I see that, it just takes me back to, there's a psychology to all of this. This is my own, right? This is Leslie's view. This is my own opinion. And what it is I think a lot of coders are very intimidated by the physician population, the clinician population. And here's why, because these folks went to medical school. They've achieved medical degrees. They have MDs behind their name, APNs, nurse practitioners. There's all of these really, really prestigious certifications and designations behind their name. So therefore you automatically become intimidated because it's like, well, how can I, with my coding language, even have a discussion with them? So I've seen two things happen. I've seen coders just bleh, I call it word vomit, right? Where they tell the physician everything they've ever learned about E&M coding in 1 hour. And it's like, what are you doing, right? It's the psychology of it. It's the fact that I need to show that I am worthy to sit in this seat when the actual objective is I need to effectively communicate to this physician what they need to do as it relates to these new coding rules and regulations. And I really pride myself on teaching the folks that have worked with me and those who I've mentored, you need to learn how to pull out of the rules and regs what is relevant to the audience in which you're providing the education to. That is important. That is very, very important. It's just like, you know, I realized very early on in my career, when a new reg comes out, the message that I provide to the chief financial officer is going to be very different from the coder. The message that I provide to Dr. Brown is going to be very different to the person that works in the IT department that needs to understand how to upload the changes relevant to the new reg. So learning how to be more confident in the fact that you are the subject matter expert when it comes to this particular subject, and then tying in the fact that there are going to be absolute times where you need to collaborate with clinical team members, physicians, APNs, nurse practitioners, those who have clinical experience, ancillary services, so that you can create the most effective educational sessions for your healthcare team members is what it's all about, basically.
100%. I feel, you know, I've talked to physicians and some of the ones I've talked to did tell me that they did not receive education and that their organization did things differently, which is fine. You know, there is some communication gaps because of that. What they really need is just to understand how their documentation affects what we do. That's all they need to know, because right, they have to focus on education. And we know documentation does more than just support the codes, right?
Yes, we do.
It tells a story so another physician can continue that care.
Right.
It's all part of it, you know. And then 2023 comes in, right? Here we go. Mm-hmm. We kind of knew it was coming, right? Where when it first came out, I was thinking, okay, well, what about the hospital? What about this?
Right.
I don't want to live with three different guideline sets. This is insane, right? So I was very excited when the AMA announced last year that they had planned to bring this in 2023, the other code sets. Now, whether or not the insurance payers, like with 2021, fall in line and follow the cookie cutter guideline that AMA has put out remains to be seen, right?
Right.
I was encouraged by some of the information that the proposed rule that just came out had mentioned, which I'll be talking about later on in another episode, but we want to just kind of talk about this 2023. What should physicians know and what should coders know about how this affects them?
Yeah, so there's a lot of significant changes coming, especially with the expansion of the 2021 E&M guidelines for all other E&M services. I think, you know, this is the time I've worked with and seen a lot of organizations handle this the wrong way. They'll wait till December 1, right? And everybody's in a scramble to do it because it's like, okay, well, we can't teach them about it now. What is this, July 12th? We can't start now, they'll forget, right? But the key is not to do it once, right? You should be doing it once now. You should be doing it once again in August, maybe again in October, and then you hit it again in December so that you have this buildup of information to the actual change happening. I think what coders, and this is always, this is another pet peeve of mine. You can see I have a lot of pet peeves, but another pet peeve of mine is I've seen many coders who don't read the changes. And I do think there's a lot of organizations providing a lot of great information out there. They're doing presentations and all of that good stuff, which is awesome. That's a great way to get information. However, even after you hear that, you should familiarize yourself with the regulation in which they're referencing from that presentation or educational session from. You should be looking at it. You should be highlighting it. You should familiarize yourself so you can feel confident about, okay, I can provide an educational session and leave out this information because it's not relevant to the physician, right? It's relevant to me and my team. And then this is the information that's relevant to the physician. So I started doing that probably about, I would say about for the last 6 years, 6-7 years ago, right? Where I developed this methodology where I would never provide an educational session about anything new to physicians or clinicians longer than 30 minutes. Never, right? I wanted them to trust the fact that I'm going to present clear, concise information to the point. We can do 8 30-minute sessions in a week, right? But each of those sessions are not going to be longer than 30 minutes as far as what I'm delivering, particularly because I want you to, one, what it does, it builds trust. It builds trust that I, Leslie Bowles, will be able to pick out the information relevant to the topic that you need to know each and every time, boom. And that's what a lot of coders do not do. They don't know how to build trust. What they do is they say, I have a certification, so that automatically creates trust. It does not. It's really important to develop innovative ways to create a trusting environment so that your physicians, one, feel comfortable, your clinicians feel comfortable coming to you and asking you specific questions, and then also being able to identify you as a subject matter expert. So that's one thing that I do. Another thing that I have seen from a new regulation standpoint is, yes, organizations will educate physicians. They may bring in an outside consultant, maybe to do a rolling, you know, maybe 4 sessions in 4 weeks type of thing, but then that's it. It goes away, right? Well, some organizations will have auditors. They'll come back and they'll audit the information to make sure that it's done, and they'll provide one-on-one education sessions. But I think it's also important to have these touch points throughout the year. So making it a part of your culture to say, my coders or those who are qualified to speak to our clinicians will get in front of them often. Whatever that looks like, having an open door policy is really, really, really important. So yeah, I think the one thing that I think is extremely important for the new changes that are coming up in 2023 is to start now. Develop your strategy for the new year. What are you going to do? Who's going to roll it out? Who's going to lead it? Who needs to know the information? I think that's super important to be able to just jump in and do.
I 100% agree. And, you know, we all know who that starts with. And we want to talk to you administrators and you practice managers. You know, that's your job, is to connect those two departments together and make that happen. Help your coders feel valued and important to the organization and connect them with those physicians. I was so grateful. My very first job as a certified coder was in orthopedics. Okay. And that's what I did the majority of my career. I stayed in that office for many years. And I loved my office manager. She was so wonderful. And we're still kind of friends to this day. And she connected me with this physician, and I'm still friends with him to this day. Like, we built this relationship, and I'm so grateful for that. And I've learned a lot from that experience that I can talk to my physician. I can have an educated professional conversation, an adult conversation, we call them, right? Yeah. And we can talk about the documentation. We can have this professional feedback. You tell me what you need. I'll tell you what I need. And we'll meet in the middle somewhere. We'll figure this out. Administrators need to bridge that gap. And yes, they are responsible for things like compliance, running reports, educating everyone how they're doing. But how can they make this happen? What are some things that administrators can do to bridge this gap?
You know, it varies from organization to organization. I've been fortunate enough to be exposed to various different types of organizations in various different types of settings, right? I think the biggest thing about it is, one, administrators have to have an understanding of how coding and billing compliance is a huge and critical aspect of any healthcare organization. That's first and foremost, right? So there's a dual responsibility there. There's the whoever's the leader of the coders or the coding management person needs to be the one to provide education to administration on the importance of coding and billing compliance, right? And I don't think it needs to be done in the aspect of, okay, I need to sit, stand in front of you and read these regs. You know, that's not what it is. There are plenty examples out there of what non-compliance looks like, right? And how to avoid it. And this is my intent. My intent is to try to save us from the penalties associated with the False Claims Act policy. And let me show you a few examples of where this went wrong, right? This is what I always do, not to scare anyone, but when you think about taking on new billing guidance, split shared, incident two, anything of that nature, let's look at people who did it wrong so we can learn how to get it right, right? So there's a dual responsibility there in the beginning. But I also think administrators and management, they need to be open to the fact that this is a gap for them. This is not an area that they have expertise in, right? Recognizing that. And I've seen a lot of, operations individuals, the ones that are really good, they recognize that and they embrace it, because good leaders can embrace where their gaps are and they can hire the right subject matter experts to fill them. Having that openness and realization that you may be making operational decisions based on that gap is part of the reason why this is happening over here is something that they need to realize. The other thing that I've seen really good operational administrators do is pull me aside and say, you know what, Leslie? Give me 45 minutes on billing and coding compliance. Can you do that for me? That is one of the best things that you can do. Pulling aside one of your strongest coders, someone from the compliance department with the coding and billing compliance hat, and say, can you just walk me through this? What do I need to be focused on? What are the risks from my perspective that I need to be worried about based on the current processes that I have in place? That is how you do that. And then everything that happens thereafter manifests into something wonderful because you're laying the groundwork for something great. So I think one of the hard things is that, again, this is all a psychology aspect. This is human behavior where operational and management people will get upset sometimes with coding professionals. Like, I don't know what you know, obviously, for sure. We understand that. We're not asking you to learn it all. We're just asking you to be able to collaborate with us and vice versa. So it's one, creating a culture, or I say it this way, eliminating the defensiveness, which is the biggest factor of why things sometimes go awry. We tend to focus so much on processes and operations when we really should be focused on behavior, right? If you have a defensive manager, I can bet you my bottom dollar that there's going to be some issue with coding. If they're defensive every time you walk into the room, there's going to be some issue with coding simply because they're not trying to hear anything you have to say. That's how I always knew who to audit from an internal strategic risk-based perspective. If I had a particular operational leader, especially in the hospital setting, who's very defensive, did not want to talk to us, we would use that rationale to say we have no insight into what's happening there. So there is risk, and it's risk because we don't know what's going on. So that would be my sort of in to that. And I think what a lot of coders have to realize is that as much as we want to say that coding as a career is just coding, it's not. There are a lot of communication and psychological aspects to what we do that have to be recognized so that you can make the headway that you need in order to be successful.
Absolutely. And we've just talked about so many things today, but I have to hit one more topic. And it's because I've heard so many what I call disturbing comments from individuals. And it comes from the administration, these things that I've heard. And they're just phrases that can really cripple an organization if they're not taken care of. And it's the thought that we don't have time to read regulations. We don't have time to read LCD policies. We don't have time to look at the guidelines. All we have time for is to enter the charges the providers type in the EMR and get it out the door. we'll fix the errors later. Huge risk.
Huge.
You know, when you're in an audit and you're presenting this information to that staff that needs to hear it, and you hear these things, it just makes your skin crawl, because what did I just do for you? You know, I was all that time trying to audit and figure out where your financial problems are.
There's enough information and guidance out there that speaks to why that statement is no longer even a relevant statement, right? When we're talking about billing and coding compliance. In fact, the Department of Justice and the OIG, when they talk about an effective compliance program, they speak about even compliance being carried out no longer just by the board and the C-suite, but also who are your middle management, which is so new, right? They've never focused, honed in on them the way they have before. And now they're saying that how can you show the effectiveness of your compliance program through your middle managers, which I think is so important, because I think operational and administrative or executive leadership folks have to understand that their decisions go beyond just them and their team, right? You create a process for an organization and it happens to be the wrong process, it can have a really poor outcome on the totality of the organization. So I think utilizing federal documents like that, using recent enforcement activity like that, to show this is not me telling you how to do your job, right? This is not me telling you what you need to be doing. This is about you understanding that when you make these decisions from an operational perspective, it affects not just this area, it affects the global aspect of the organization. And here are some external documents that speak to why this is so important. I even use the Yates memo, right? The Yates memo, when it talks about identifying non-compliance, which includes coding non-compliance, it talks about identifying the individual who created the environment in which this non-compliance flourished and holding them accountable. That's really, really important to share. That's really, really important for them to know so that they can understand that although they may not have all the answers to everything, they need to be able to consult the right individuals from the organization so that they can make the best decision. So, I think a lot of it is education. That's the biggest piece, educating your administrators, them educating themselves, and also reaching out to other folks so that they can get educated, working with their compliance department, revenue integrity, their billing and coding compliance department, and just tapping into that knowledge is super, super important.
I completely agree. And, you know, everything we talked about today is going to be just so vital for organizations to hear. And, you know, we talk to organizations all the time about these items, and hopefully this platform that we're using to get the word out will be useful to many organizations. So I think the key takeaways today, like you mentioned, education, communication, and understanding each other, making that available. So thank you so much, Leslie, for all your insights and your knowledge. And I know our audience is just going to eat up this episode. It's going to be on a favorite episode, I'm pretty sure. It's going to be on my list for sure. So thank you for joining today. And where can our audience find you if they want to reach out to you?
Yeah, so I can be found on LinkedIn under Leslie V. Bowles. I also am the co-owner and president of Review Healthcare. So we also have a website, www.reviewhealthcare.com. We also are on LinkedIn. You can find us there. And I look forward to hearing from all of you. And Jennifer, thank you again for the opportunity to speak with you and your listeners. And I really, really appreciate it.
Wonderful. Well, thank you everyone for listening to the Life as a Coder podcast. This has been Jennifer McNamara. And I want to thank our sponsors over at OncoSpark and our amazing podcast producer, Gabriel Fast with Highland Productions. Until next time.
Thanks for joining the Life as a Coder podcast. Please feel free to rate or subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. We appreciate that effort. It helps us share the show with other healthcare professionals just like you. Join us next Wednesday for another episode. We'll catch you then.